Welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In art school in the 1980s, graphic design was for the neat and tidy kids, the ones who knew their way around a ruler and wouldn't smudge the ink. Ellen Lupton was not one of those kids. Despite that, she made a name for herself in the world of design and is also a curator, educator, and critic. Ellen is the author of several books, one of which, Thinking with Type, has become an invaluable and widely read industry resource, and we talked a little bit about how she discovered the language of text on a page. A Baltimore native, Ellen now splits her time between here and New York. In Baltimore, she directs the Graphic Design MFA program at Maryland Institute College of Art, otherwise known as MICA, and in New York, she works as the Curator of Contemporary Design at Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum. Despite being among the elite in her industry, Ellen champions do-it-yourself culture. She has several books on the topic and believes everyone can engage with design, whether it's making a birthday card or putting together a personal website. Ellen considers it a personal mission to open people's eyes to the design that exists all around them, though we also talked about how good design is often intended to go unnoticed. I don't know anything about design or typography, so I really enjoyed getting a brief education from Ellen, as well as learning more about her childhood and the ways that the industry has changed over the years. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for coming in. I would love to start by reading this great quote of yours from a talk you gave, I believe, that typefaces are like the air we breathe, the water we drink, the pot we smoke. That's great. Can you tell me a little bit about how you discovered design and typography?
Sure. I went to art school in the early 80s at the Cooper Union in New York City, and I had studied art in high school here in Baltimore where I grew up, but I really had no idea what design was. It was not as generally known in the culture back then as today when we have IKEA and everybody has different typefaces on their computer. Back then, design was pretty much a walled city that you didn't know about until you sort of asked. And so I got to art school and discovered this whole field that is art, but it's also utility. And it's something that people use, something that you communicate with. It's a profession and a business. And that just really blew me away because this was a whole different way that I, as a young creative person, could imagine becoming an artist and engaging the world in a different way from what I had seen in museums, you know, the painter or sculptor kind of working alone. This was a whole new model for what art could do in society.
And what originally brought you to art school? What path did you see following before your eyes were open to design?
Well, in high school, I was a typical high school artist. I did drawing and painting. And I was, you know, pretty good at that. But I had a strong humor bent in my work. I liked doing cartoons. I liked doing things that had maybe a literary quality to them. And that is different from fine art. That is more towards design, illustration, communication, storytelling, narrative. And the piece that I really had no idea about is typography and type. Is visual language. Type makes words into pages or websites or books or ads that communicate value around language. And I had no idea about that. And if you picture in your mind a Microsoft Word document that you just open up and it's automatically in Times Roman and all the type is the same size, that has no design. And if you then picture in your mind the menu at Chipotle and think about the lettering and the materials and even the language that is used in commercial typography, it has a voice, it has a shape, it has a presence. And for me, that is what my whole life has become, is thinking about how design tells stories, how design communicates to people.
Now we know so much more about design, you know, with the internet than I imagine you did when you were in school. Did you have to reconcile, you know, originally wanting to be a fine artist, now going into this more commercial field? And how was design regarded at that time?
When I was in art school, design was the thing that the neat kids did. You know, you had to be able to use a ruler precisely and draw perfect boxes in ink and create a curved line, which was really difficult, a smooth curved line. Things that I was actually really bad at, and that now we have this amazing software that means you don't have to be able to do those things. You have to think in an orderly way, but you don't have to be the person that could hold a pen perfectly and never smear the ink against the ruler, which I did all the time. So I think it's a better world right now. And it's actually much more inviting to a broader group of people. Like, really, anybody can enter into design in some capacity. It's just a very welcoming medium.
Did you find that you were able to apply what you enjoyed about the fine arts you practiced in high school in your college career and beyond as a designer?
Absolutely. So design uses color and shape and pattern. It uses images and photography and drawing. It uses all the elements of visual art, but it uses them to solve a problem or convey a message or tell a story. It's always directed outwardly at users, at an audience, a client. There's always a situation that design is responding to. And that's really different from the fine arts. It's a very different mindset.
So expanding on that, what else do you think makes design different than fine art? Or is design fine art?
Well, sometimes a designer can make a piece that exists as fine art, and there's wonderful work being done, for example, in furniture making, where you have pieces that are poetic and provocative and aren't intended for industrial production. They're more thought pieces and almost sculpture that references traditional furniture forms. But by and large, most of the design that we encounter every day is right there in your environment, and it's supporting your activity. It's not the main event. It's not the focus of our attention. It's the creation of a useful world. If you think about your car or your apartment, there's all kinds of interface and surface and color and objects that you need there to complete a task. And in a way, you don't notice them until you need to make use of it.
Yeah, I'm curious if you always picked up on those utilitarian elements before you knew you wanted to pursue a career in design, or was that something your eyes kind of like had to be opened up to?
I really had to be educated to recognize design in my environment. And I think today, people are much more attuned to it. We have a much more sophisticated design world. Even a fast food restaurant or IKEA is one of my great examples, because everything at IKEA has been designed, not just the products that you buy, but the tags and the labels and the restaurant and the staircase and the path that you take through the store. None of that has been left to chance. And that's a, you know, fairly recent development that we encounter these very well-designed and highly considered experiences as consumers.
Well, I was hoping to go back a little bit to your childhood. You said you grew up around here?
Yeah, I grew up right here in Baltimore, not too far from the Baltimore Sun.
Oh, great. What was your childhood like, and how did it inform your path?
I grew up in Charles Village near the Hopkins Homewood campus, which is a really cool place for a young person to be, because I had access to the Baltimore Museum of Art, which was really fun, and I could go there. I have a twin sister, and it was safe for us to just like walk over there and go to the museum by ourselves. We spent a lot of time on Greenmount Avenue shopping in the stores. There was a Woolworth store, and there's the Goodwill that I think is still there, and the great little restaurants. And so having that sort of full range of the city, you know, from Hopkins Homewood to Greenmount Avenue, was a pretty cool slice of life that was just really great for a kid growing up to see all that and experience all that.
Do you think a childhood Ellen would be surprised where you ended up now?
I don't think I could have pictured it. I sometimes think about that little girl and wondering what I would have made of it.
Well, speaking of your sister, you've worked with your sister. She is a writer and a scholar,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
A Shakespeare scholar?
My sister is a world-renowned Shakespeare scholar, and she went to college at Johns Hopkins University and got her PhD at Yale University and now teaches in California at UC Irvine. And she is an expert in Shakespeare, but I turned her on to design, and she's a little bit of my lab rat experiment in teaching someone who's not a professional designer to become one and to use design in her everyday life. So she makes bar mitzvah invitations and posters for literary events at her school and websites and things that are needed in her life that connect her socially with other people. And they're pretty good. They're pretty good for a PhD in English literature.
So you guys have done your DIY books together, which is Design It Yourself and then a children's version, right?
Yes, we made a book called DIY Kids with our children at the time. We had six kids between us, and we enlisted them for about a year and a half doing design projects. Like every weekend, mom had another crazy project to do. And this book is a guide to design for kids, illustrated with kids' art. So it's no perfect Disney princesses. It's all raw and real and has that incredible humor that kids bring to their work. And then we did a book called Design Your Life, which is actually more for the moms. It's a book about how to kind of look at your environment and have fun and laugh at things that work and enjoy things that don't work. Sort of looking at everything kind of backwards. It's a really fun book that is a kind of narrative tour of our everyday landscape from a design point of view. Everything from time management to how to set the table.
I think you're known in design circles as taking a very democratic approach to design, not an elite one. Where does your interest in DIY come from, and why not be elite with it, I guess, when you are at the level that you're at?
Well, that's a really good question. DIY for me is something that I live. So I'm a museum curator. I work at Cooper Hewitt Smithsonian Design Museum in New York City, where I organize exhibitions for the public, and it's a very professional kind of academic job. But unlike the other curators, I have this magic skill called graphic design. So I can make my own labels or design my own book or create an awesome PowerPoint with video and animation, and just I don't have to ask an assistant to do that for me. So for me, having that ability to apply graphic design to my professional work is a DIY thing. Typical curators don't know how to do that, and it slows you down if you can't do things yourself. So I have always been a hands-on intellectual. My philosophy, I call it the direct manipulation of content. And I think journalists today are doing this, that any journalist your generation has to be able to operate the content management system and edit some video and look at how the layout of your article looks on the web and change it to make it better and edit photographs, crop photographs, choose the right images. This direct manipulation of content is a transformation of media in our time. And to me, that's kind of the essence of DIY for designers, is to think about how everybody can have this relationship to content and media. So you're a professional journalist, you need to know this stuff. But why shouldn't an English professor or a high school teacher or someone running their own auto shop also be able to create content and create media and play with their own image and their own advertising, or create a neighborhood organization and be able to get the word out. That's DIY.
Yeah, I remember being very frustrated as a kid if there wasn't the right clip art that matched, you know, what I had in my mind for my playbill or my perfect project or whatever it was. So I can really relate to that. I was hoping you could tell me more about your work at Cooper Hewitt, which is a Smithsonian Museum in New York, and it's the only museum in the U.S. Devoted to design. Is that correct?
We're the only museum dedicated exclusively to the history and future practice of design. There's a number of museums that have design departments like MoMA, or museums that look at design and craft or design and the fine arts. But we are the nation's design museum.
So what does your job as a curator entail?
What I do is create concepts for exhibitions, and I develop that content into presentations for the public. So when you go to a museum, you are walking through an environment that a curator has selected for you. Sometimes we look at pictures on the wall and just think, oh, they were always that way, or, you know, that's just the way it is. But next time you go to a museum, think about, what story is the museum trying to tell you? What picture of history or society or somebody's life, you know, what is being presented? That's what curators do. And I do that at Cooper Hewitt. And I come up with the ideas and the stories that we want to tell the public about design.
It seems like a real storyteller thread runs through all of your work.
Yes, it's my obsession right now.
And you've also, you write, you've written for the New York Times, you've written beautiful essays, and you have many other books as well.
Yes.
I also read that you were working on a novel. Is that still in the works?
Well, that's sort of on the back burner. I've been enrolled in the MA program in creative writing at Hopkins, which has really been fun. I take one or two courses a year, and it's really high quality. I so believe in lifelong education, that you should just keep learning new things and studying the craft behind everything you do. It's easy when you become successful as a professional to think that you've mastered it, but there's always things that you can do better. So I've been studying fiction and writing, and the beautiful thing is it has improved all my nonfiction writing. So the novel may never get done, but I have learned so much about how to engage readers in narrative.
And do you think that carries over into your design work as well?
I think about it all the time. I think about stories everywhere. And in fact, I'm now working on a book called Design is Storytelling that takes the subject head on and is a guide for designers to think about how to incorporate action and sensory detail and theme and change of energy, change of perspective, all the things that we expect from a great novel or a wonderful movie. Designers can do that too.
Did you have any kind of like aha moment, whether it was in finally realizing like, oh, it's design that I'm good at, design that I love, or whether everything clicked that, oh, design is about storytelling? Like, can you point to anything like that in your life?
Yeah, there's a couple of really important moments, and they really go back to my experience as a college student at Cooper Union, a great school where I'm proud my daughter is going in the fall, so we have two generations of Cooper kids in my house. But one was discovering typography, because I had been a visual artist, but I was always good at writing and enjoyed writing, and typography was the discovery of what language looks like. That language is not just sound, it's not just abstract ideas, it has this physical form. And without that form, it is way weak. It just doesn't compel people as much as language that has been given shape through typography. And if again, if you think about a Microsoft Word document and how boring that is to read, how little it says to you about the tone and the voice and the origins of the content, that should put you in mind of how powerful typography is. Imagine Vogue magazine as a Word document. It mm-hmm. would be dead. It has no presence. And the other thing was, when I was in school, we were told that design is problem solving. And this was a revelation to me because I had never thought about that. And one of the great examples is the New York City subway, the signage. It's this wonderful system with Helvetica and colored dots and numbers that is 40 years old and still looks great and is still growing and still being applied. And that was really cool to think about designers creating these systems that solve problems for people. But I always wondered what was missing from that. It seemed to me that to say design is problem solving leaves out a lot of the other aspects of design. What about beauty? What about sensation? What about emotion? What about engaging people emotionally? What about politics or critique? And design can do those things too. So that was inspiring to me as a young student to discover problem solving, but also to question it. And now I'm writing this book about storytelling that I think makes a beautiful complement to the problem solving definition of what design is.
What problems do you hope to solve with design?
I hope to raise awareness of design. That's my big mission as an educator and curator and writer, is I want more people to see that the world has been designed, that human beings have made an effort to create all the things that we use. And that's the overriding message of all my work.
Yeah, I was going to ask more about that because it can be frustrating when people don't realize the level of work that goes into something. And I'm sure design, more than many other professions, is often overlooked. You don't realize that your coffee cup was designed by someone. It's just a basic looking coffee cup to you. Do you ever encounter that frustration?
I do. I understand your comment. But in a way, design is often not supposed to be noticed. And we often don't notice design until it breaks. We don't notice that something is there until it stops working for us. So if you spend your whole day noticing all the design elements of the parking meter and the stripes on the road and how the curb cuts are made and the storefronts, you would go crazy. Like, part of the purpose of design is to create this smooth passage for your day and to not be constantly calling attention to itself. Once you become more attuned to it, it is really fun to see those details and to ask, you know, why did they make the bike path green? You know, in Brazil, they're red, and Baltimore, they're green. So interesting. But it's really important if you're just riding your bike not to be worrying about that, because you don't want to get in an accident.
Right. Well, going back to your role as an educator, you are the head of the graphic design MFA program at MICA, right?
Yes, I am.
So what does that entail, and what do your MFA students do?
Well, we run a very vibrant international MFA program at MICA. We attract students from all over the world. And these are students that come to us already quite skilled as graphic designers. They know lots of software. Many of them have worked professionally. They have really strong point of view individually as designers. And they come to MICA to learn new technology. They come to expand their sense of what's possible in design, to create experimental work, to create entrepreneurial work, to be the person responsible for a project from start to finish, as opposed to designers normally sort of flow into a team, a project that already exists that needs design. In an MFA program, you have to drive the whole car, you have to build the whole plane, and it's pretty exciting for people to experience that.
When you came into the newsroom today, you saw a poster that was designed by one of your former students. What does that feel like to see, you know, their work out there in the world?
I love that. I love encountering things that my students have created. That particular poster is a series of posters that are quotes from The Wire. And that's such a piece of Baltimore lore. And any place I go in the world and I say, oh, I'm from Baltimore, people always say, oh, The Wire. Like, well, that's not the only thing in Baltimore,
right.
But that is a powerful piece of iconography. So it's fun to see people all over the world collect these posters with quotes from The Wire.
Well, in your dual roles, you spend time in both New York and Baltimore. Do you see both of the cities influencing you in different ways, or what do you get from each of those living experiences?
I love living in two cities. New York is always on. It's super hyper. It's super dense. You're always moving from A to B. You're always walking. You're always in motion. And in Baltimore, I live in Roland Park, which is a beautiful and peaceful place. So it's very nice to have that experience back and forth between big city and little city.
What are some of the qualities that your favorite educators shared? What do you hope to emulate with your students?
I had teachers at Cooper Union and today at Hopkins who call attention to why things are the way they are. I think we often think about art as all about making, but it's also about unmaking. It's about understanding the thought process behind the creation of a chair or a typeface or a story or a scene in a TV show or a joke. Like, all these things have a structure and a logic to them. And my greatest teachers have always been people that drew attention to that why behind how things got to be the way they are, creative things.
So what would be the best compliment a student could give you, or your greatest accomplishment, you know, a student coming out of the program, you'd be thrilled if they said blank?
Well, that's funny. I have a book called Thinking with Type, which is widely used as a textbook by art students really all around the world. And recently at a conference, a young woman came up to me after my talk and said that, oh, Thinking with Type, that's the first book I ever understood. And I was like really delighted, but also alarmed, hoping that it was the first design book she had ever understood. And that surely there are other books she understood. But I think there's a way in which when you can open somebody's mind to this, to me, this miracle of this field of graphic design, that graphic design is this embodiment of ideas that you can enter into and use for your own purposes. I feel like when I have that aha moment with a young person, that they suddenly recognize that design is something that welcomes them, that's super exciting to me.
Is that an aha moment that you think anyone can have? Or is it only strictly design-oriented people, I guess?
I think anybody can have some relationship to creating media. I think the term design can be too limiting. I like the term publishing, because publishing is about creating ideas and sharing them with the public. And that's the goal. The goal is to share ideas. And design, and I'm talking here about graphic design as opposed to product design or architecture, graphic design is about communicating ideas. And if you focus on what you're trying to do, then the how you get there becomes less important.
Can you paint the scene for me, what the field was like when you entered it and how it's different now?
When I entered the graphic design field in the mid-80s, the Macintosh computer had just been introduced, and only a handful of people were, quote, experimenting with it. So when I learned design, everything was done by hand, a lot of photographic processes, a lot of cut and paste. You had to be very, very precise. By about 1991, the Macintosh and its associated software had become the industry standard. And now digital production was the norm, and everybody had to learn all of that. I had to learn it myself, because when I was in school, that wasn't a thing yet. In 1996, like, the internet was the next revolution, and then following that was social media and apps and right, it's this ongoing transformation of technology. And each of those transformations has led to the public being more exposed and more interested in visual communication, which I think is really amazing.
It seems like it was probably a pretty male-dominated field back then. Is that fair?
Yeah, graphic design was very male-dominated in the 80s. It's still male-dominated at the top. So if you look for the kind of top speakers at conferences and the designers who are running big companies, that is still dominated by men. There are more and more women reaching that level in the field, and there's many women with successful careers in graphic design at every level. But at the very top, it's still a struggle. It's a struggle for women to make it to that very top.
Do you feel that struggle personally, and how do you fight against that?
I think as a design educator and a museum curator, I work within an institutional environment that is more friendly towards women than the purely business environment. College campuses have traditionally welcomed women. I'm a mom. That is always a challenge for any creative person to put together child rearing and a successful career. So for me, working in these institutions has been really helpful, as has been having a very supportive partner who is equal and has always shared in all of the duties and responsibilities of running a house and having kids. So I'm very lucky for that. I think it's much harder for women who are working purely in a business environment. I think the pressure to be there till 10 o'clock at night is very strong. And that is tough when you reach a point in your life where you can't do that or don't want to do that anymore.
Have you had to make a lot of trade-offs in your career, or what are some of the risks that you have taken?
I think any working person is constantly making trade-offs. I think working parents make a lot of trade-offs, whether you're a man or a woman. I think kids would love to have two parents or three or four parents at home with them all the time. Most of us can't do that. I think that when you try to put home and family and work all on an equal footage, all of it's going to suffer a little bit. But I think that's okay. I believe in compromise. I believe that I've had a great life, and I've created some interesting experiences for my kids and produced a lot of material, a lot of books and content that have been valuable to the world. I think all that content would have been even better if that's all I had to do. I think my kids would have loved it if I didn't have to go to work, but that's not the decision I made. And I think you can have a really great life and make a lot of contributions if you accept that there's an element of compromise, that it's all going to be a little half-assed.
You juggle a million balls at once, it sounds like, even more than we've even touched on here, between being a curator, educator, author, writer, you give lectures, things like that. So you have come to accept that things will suffer?
I think you just have to, you know, there is a book like 20 years ago called The Good Enough Parent. And I feel like the good enough everything, the good enough home cook, the good enough housekeeper, the good enough mom, the good enough curator, the good enough teacher, you know, that you just do what you can. And you can't do it all. You can't do everything perfectly. And if you want to do just one thing, maybe that will be perfect. But if you have a complex life, every day you're going to be choosing to do X instead of Y.
I think this good enough model might be like a little rebellious too, because women especially, I feel like we suffer from a lot of imposter syndrome. And if you can't do it perfectly and can't do it the best, sometimes you don't do it at all. And so I think this kind of good enough, try everything approach is really admirable.
Yeah. I mean, I've been reading about the confidence gap and how, you know, many women don't step forward and try things because they're afraid it won't be perfect and they won't be good enough. And people that just jump in and give it a shot, at least they learn something from that. And if you are always holding back and waiting, you're not going to get anywhere. So it's okay to make mistakes.
What have some of your mistakes been?
Oh, I have a book that I published with the museum that has a typo on the spine of the book.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was humiliating. It was not a good thing. And it was because of rushing and not getting everybody to look at it before it went to press. So you can make some pretty dumb mistakes, but nobody was hurt. And I didn't even get fired. So whatever.
Right. What's the biggest misconception about what you do?
Well, I think with curating, I think people have an image of museum curators constantly on airplanes going to art fairs. And really, that sounds fun. But most of what curators or designers do is email. You know, mostly we're communicating and planning and sending out messages to people that are very mundane, just like Hillary Clinton. It's all email. And you have to get efficient at that and get through it so you can do the creative part, which is usually about 5% of the job.
Did you have glamorous expectations when you went to art school?
I was scared. I was scared I wouldn't make it. You know, I was scared that this was a narcissistic idea that I could go and be a creative professional, you know, that only Picasso was allowed to be an artist. And what I learned is that art is a lot more than that. It isn't just about being a superstar painter with a solo show at MoMA. That's very few people. But that art is a much broader endeavor that includes information design for the newspaper and animated titles for a movie and books and magazines and designing exhibitions, designing stores and menus and patterns for wallpaper, all kinds of stuff that's just much broader.
What excites you right now about design?
I love this period of openness. I think the tools that we have available have enabled more people to engage in design in a casual way. And I'm really excited by that. I continue to find that inspiring.
Do you see a lot of self-taught designers in your work?
I see lots of people experimenting and playing with design and doing things maybe at a small scale or a personal scale. Sometimes designers worry that the whole DIY thing will take away our jobs. And I don't think that's the case. I think that when an everyday person experiments with Photoshop or Illustrator or creates a website on Wix, they actually come away with like more respect for what professional designers do. They can see the limits of what a kind of quick take on a website or a business card might result. And often they end up creating something that wouldn't have been made otherwise. You know, that somebody with a dog walking service who creates their own graphic identity wouldn't have been able to hire a professional to do that. So that's not a job that would have been done by a MICA alum. It just wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. And so what you see now is more people having fun with visuals and having fun with publishing and media, and then ultimately having more respect for the art of it at its highest level.
Yeah, you see a lot of pieces now. In the beginning, everyone was saying journalists need to learn how to code. But now people are like, no, you go be a good reporter because you'll realize how hard it is to code and you will have respect for that profession and just go outsource it. So it doesn't seem like those jobs are going away.
Yeah, and there's so many tools that journalists use that are an interface between you and the code. And you have to be able to do that. You have to be able to have good taste and good judgment and to be able to see what a paragraph looks like. You know, it can't be 50 sentences.
Right.
It has to have a shape. Mm-hmm. And that's not code. That's like judgment about the visuality of content.
To what extent do you think about your legacy and what do you think your legacy will be?
Oh, gosh, I don't think about a legacy. I guess one thing about publishing books is they stick around. Websites may go away, but books have this weird permanence to them. They go out of print, they go out of fashion, but they're hanging out somewhere and they get revived and rediscovered. So that's kind of fun to think about, having a bunch of books that maybe in 50 years when the technology is completely different, there'll be sort of weird retro records of what we did.
Ellen, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Ellen Lupton. Female Trouble comes out every Tuesday, and you can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, BaltimoreSun.com, and all the major podcast apps. If you like Female Trouble, it would really help us out if you subscribed and gave us a rating on iTunes. You can also follow all of our updates on Twitter at FML Trouble. Our theme music is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring Baltimore's own TT the Artist. Thanks again, and see you next week.